Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
And today, yet again, we're joined by our China editor, Shannon. Thanks a lot for joining us, Shannon.
Sure. It's a pleasure, guys.
Yeah, and the reason we have Shannon here is because we'll be devoting the entirety of this podcast to discussing the recent pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, which have turned out to be the largest mass incident in China since 1989 related to calling for democracy. Now, let's just get straight into it, guys. Where do you guys see these protests going? Obviously, a big condition that a lot of us are interested in is the success condition in these protests. And just today, as we were about to begin this podcast, reports emerged that scheduled talks between the Hong Kong central government and the protesters were canceled. So, Shannon, why don't you take this one? So where do you see these protests going, and what will it take for them to be considered successful by most of the protesters?
I think that is really the central question. What most of the protesters want is their idea of universal suffrage, which of course involves not only one person, one vote, but this idea that they also have a broader say in who is nominated to be a candidate that they can then choose from. I think Richard Bush at the Brookings Institute used the analogy that it's like giving people a choice. You know, what do you want to drink? Do you want Coke, Coke Zero, or Cherry Coke? So that's kind of what the protesters want, is they want a broader choice that brings in people from maybe different parties, from different affiliations. But Beijing has been very clear since the beginning that this is not something that they intend to allow to happen. And I think if Beijing was in the mood to compromise, they had ample opportunity to do that before issuing the National People's Congress Standing Committee decision that they issued at the end of August. There were plenty of ways, and a lot of people have been repeating these since the protests began. There are plenty of creative ways that Beijing could have met the protesters in the middle before these protests even started. They could have, for example, lowered the threshold for how many people on the committee have to approve candidates. But right now, the committee, the nominating committee, is 1,200 people, and you need to have 50% approve your candidacy. And that target is so high that it's basically impossible for someone who's not Beijing approved to get the necessary amount of votes. And that the decision from the NPCSC was even stricter than a lot of the pro-democracy advocates had expected. And now that Beijing has kind of laid that line down, it's going to be incredibly difficult for them to back away from it or be seen as compromising in any way. And I don't think that's something they're going to be willing to do. So there's really not a resolution in sight, at least that I can see right now. The Pan Democrats have basically said, we're just going to block this in the legislature. We're not going to have any reform, and we can try to get actual universal suffrage later down the line rather than the half suffrage that Beijing is offering us.
Shannon, would you say, I mean, it seems to me that, like, the whole point, the reason why Beijing, like, had these regulations and made it so 50% of the body had to approve a candidates was specifically because it wanted to make sure that it could veto any candidate it doesn't like. And so, I mean, you said that a lot of the protesters feel that there could have been a creative solution on Beijing's part, but would those creative solutions have met China's goals, or the CCP's goals, at least as I see them, which is basically to be able to veto a candidate?
I think Beijing is kind of being a little – they're lacking in self-confidence is what I would say. I don't think they really need to have veto power per se over who is nominated. You know, if you have – the pan-democracy candidates don't have a majority in Hong Kong's legislature. They're not the majority party. So the odds of a fringe candidate that Beijing – completely disapproves of ever being elected are very, very small, or at least they were before Beijing came down with a really heavy hand and took a hardline stance on this and really kind of drummed up discontent against itself. So I think, again, it's all about creative thinking. Beijing could have approached this more creatively. And I think with giving up very, very little on their end, they could have achieved a lot of goodwill from the majority of the protesters. There probably would have been maybe a smaller minority that remains discontent, But it's, I think it's really a missed opportunity for Beijing in not being willing to at least try to consider alternative options when they were making this decision.
Right.
I agree with that. But I actually, I mean, I see this as an ongoing problem in a different context for the CCP. I mean, for instance, one thing that, you know, I don't know if it happens, how far it happens, but it seems like, you know, even the Chinese academics and the foreign policy experts and stuff are sometimes like discouraged from talking to Western or writing for Western newspapers and stuff. And certainly what they write is censored to a degree. Obviously, they have a lot more leeway than they used to. But, you know, I see that as kind of, counterproductive for China's goals, because there might be a few academics who criticize China's foreign policy. But if you just let everyone say what they want, the average Chinese foreign policy experts are going to be strongly in favor of Chinese foreign policy, just the same way that most U.S. foreign policy experts are strongly in favor of the U.S. foreign policy, even if there's like a Noam Chomsky exception every once in a while. So I don't see that as that surprising, even though I think you're right, it's counterproductive for the CCP's goal.
Yeah, I don't think that it is surprising. It's just a little disappointing that we're still seeing this tendency to overcompensate and lean more heavily towards strict control at the same time as China is telling the world that they're going to start opening up and changing things.
Mm-hmm. That said, were you guys surprised at all by the manner in which Beijing has responded to all this? I mean, when these protests broke out, there was a lot of sort of dread in the Western media that we could be seeing another 1989 emerging. I mean, I was obviously skeptical of that from the beginning, but I was just wondering, what are your takes on how Beijing has actually decided to respond?
Beijing has really just kind of kicked the can to the Hong Kong government, and it's put the Hong Kong government in a pretty much impossible position, because Beijing has made it clear we're not going to compromise. So therefore, Chief Executive Xi Weilong is not allowed to compromise. He's not allowed to offer these protesters anything. And yet Beijing is telling him, go deal with these protesters. And, you know, there's really nothing he can do that Beijing will allow him to do that will appease the protesters. And so it allows Beijing to kind of sit this one out and let Xi Weilong and his local government take all the fall, whether people want to criticize them for being too lenient or for not being lenient enough, you know, depending on the perspective. Either way, it's Hong Kong's problem, not Beijing's problem.
Right.
Hey, can I just add? Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
Go for it.
Can I just add that? I mean, I think this is typical. I think we see this a lot where the CCP tries to have the local governments out in front on the front lines dealing with people. We had a piece in February of last year by Steve Hess about why there was never an Arab Spring in China. And the point he made was that one of the things he focused on was that China has these local people in China tend to focus on the local governments, and they express their anger to the local governments who they perceive as being sometimes the oppressors, and they see Beijing is almost like an ally to try to rein in these local government officials who are abusing their power. And I think this is a very typical response by China to have the local government be the face of the anti-protests. But go on, Ankit. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I was just I wanted to kind of gauge your feelings on whether it would be a realistic and face-saving solution to have Xi Weilong step down, which is something that the protesters have begun to demand. And obviously today, part of the reason the talks were called off is because Lung stepping down was starting to become sort of, you know, essentially an unmovable demand for the protesters. Now, would this be a realistic solution? It seems like it helps Beijing save face. It helps the protests save face, even if they don't get their broader demands about universal suffrage reform. What do you think about this, Shannon?
I don't think that Xi Weilong stepping down, I think in the short term, it would actually galvanize the protesters, which is what Beijing is afraid of course, is that they would see, okay, we got them to accede to this demand. But both sides really know that Xi Weilong is not the problem. He's just a symptom of the problem, which is that Beijing wants to have a certain amount of say in Hong Kong affairs, and the protesters believe that constitutes undue interference on the part of Beijing. So, for example, we had a situation back in the early 2000s. Deng Qihua was the chief executive of Hong Kong, And there were major, major protests in Hong Kong over Article 23 of the Basic Law, which is basically an anti-secession, anti-sedition law. The people in Hong Kong were very afraid would, in effect, turn them into an extension of the PRC, because it would greatly restrict freedom of the press and freedom of expression under this anti-secession law. The protests, and then, of course, there are other factors, the way that he handled SARS and economic factors as well. But eventually, Peng Shih-hua, the chief executive back in the early 2000s, lost support, and he was forced to resign. But he was replaced by the chief secretary, who was Donald Tang, who was also equally popular with Beijing, and he eventually became the new chief executive with Beijing's blessing. So today we have a similar sort of thing going on. It's possible that these protests will reach a point where Chiu Ai-Lung just can't govern effectively and he's forced to step down. But under the Basic Law, at least in the short term, he would be replaced by Chief Secretary Carrie Lam, who is equally unpopular with the protesters, especially as she was the one who officially called off the government protest talks today by calling the protesters insincere in their desire for constructive dialogue. So I think in the short term, the protesters would be really galvanized. In the long term, it wouldn't change anything because they would very quickly realize that the new chief executive, whether it's Carrie Lam or they quickly appoint an official new chief executive, is basically has exactly the same stance.
And Zach, do you think that Chiu Ai-Lung stepping down would have any real impact?
I feel like the whole time that those protest leaders have been trying to have gradually and subtly made that a goal of the protest. The protest didn't start over Chiu Ai-Lung. They started over Beijing trying to veto presidential or chief executive candidates. So I actually think that they might, because I don't think the protesters' leaders think that they have any chance of succeeding in their main goals, they might try to use that to, if that happened, to declare victory and go home. I agree that it could galvanize them at the same time, but the point is that Chiu Ai-Lung has nothing to do with this, as Shannon was saying. It's nothing to do with this actual leader, and so I've been concerned on why these protesters are trying to make it about Chiu Ai-Lung when it's clearly about Beijing, and it's really distracting from the problem, in my view, trying to call for his resignation or whatever, because Chiu Ai-Lung is just he does what the CCP will let him do, mainly. And so I think this is not have anything to do with the problem that the protesters are angry about.
Well, let's talk about the protesters a bit. Particularly, the nomenclature during these protests is very interesting. Obviously, we've seen the media refer to this as Occupy Central, which actually refers to a smaller group within the broader protest that's existed in Hong Kong for much longer than this bout of protest. And then the Western media has also controversially referred to this as the Umbrella Revolution, obviously hearkening to the imagery that we see from Hong Kong of protesters holding up umbrellas to hold back tear gas canisters and essentially just holding them up to the Hong Kong police. Obviously, that sort of plays into Beijing's narrative about this being a color revolution that's being fostered by, Western powers. And I think, Shannon, you had a really interesting piece up on this, on why the United States and other Western countries are actually correct to not make a huge deal from their governments about these protests in Hong Kong. Do you want to tell us a bit more about how Beijing is trying to sell this image of the protests being fostered by foreign powers?
Sure. So Beijing has a long history of looking at really almost any domestic protest movement, whether in China or in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Ukraine, and saying, okay, the West did this. The West is responsible for this. The claims range from the West is financially backing the protesters to the West is actually sending secret CIA operatives to pose as protesters. The whole nine yards in terms of what the West is doing. But the general sentiment is that all of these protests against autocratic governments are basically the West trying to sow chaos in enemy countries. And China's argument has always been that the West, in particular the U.S., is very actively trying to do this within China as well. And so the Hong Kong protests tap into this in some very interesting ways. There's basically the story in the Chinese media is that this is not organic discontent from Hong Kongers. They've consistently tried to marginalize the protests to say they speak, first of all, for only a small minority of Hong Kongers. And second of all, that even the small minority who are the protesters, their discontent is not genuine. It's been fostered by the West. Their minds have been twisted by Western propaganda, and they're being used as tools. And obviously, this makes the protesters extremely angry because they're being dismissed by Beijing and their concerns are not being taken seriously. And the nomenclature has really become a core issue of this because the term umbrella revolution sounds so similar to some of the names of the color revolutions that you had back in the early 2000s. So the Chinese media kind of snatched onto this as proof that the Western media, and therefore the Western governments, that of course we all know control the Western media, were indeed using this as a color revolution that was trying to kind of topple the first domino in a long line of secessionist movements that ultimately tear China apart. So the protesters have actually said, you know, let's stop using the term umbrella revolution. And I think in part that's because they know how dangerous it is for them to be associated with this idea of revolution and color revolution.
Right. If I could have put this somewhat in more abstract, I mean, this is a common theme for any like mass movements. The government's goal is to make the protesters not be the fight in any mass movement is for the society, the medium people, the middle political ideology people in the society. So what the protesters want to do is get as broad array of support as possible throughout Hong Kong and and perhaps China writ large. And what the Beijing government wants to do is marginalize the protesters by saying that they're not like your average Hong Kongers or Chinese, these are a bunch of radicals, and that they're working for foreigners. So this is all taking place in the context of trying to win the hearts and minds of your average Hong Konger, the political middle in Hong Kong. And so this is common. A lot of regimes try to depict protesters as foreign. This is one of the reasons why Assad is said to support, has kind of helped support the rise of the Islamic State in Syria, not only because it would alienate the Western states or U.S. and stuff from supporting the protest movement, but also because it would alienate, you know, your average Sunni Syrian from the opposition movement because they don't want to live under the reign of the Islamic State.
Right. Well, I think that's all the time we have today. Thanks a lot for joining us, Shannon. For readers and listeners, we'll obviously be covering the remainder of the Hong Kong protests over at The Diplomat, so keep an eye on our website. Thanks a lot, Shannon.
Sure, it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll be back next week with more. Thanks.